This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive. This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Is someone you know in prison or jail? Do you want to know more about the American system of justice and how it is applied to poor people and people of color? Have you ever thought about why so many blacks and Latinos are stopped, frisked, and arrested, or why so many of them fill up the prisons? If you want answers to these questions and others, tune in to On the Count, the Prison and Criminal Justice Report, the only program on radio that is produced by people who were formerly incarcerated. Saturday mornings from 10:30 until noon over WBAI 99.5 on the FM dial, or visit our archives at www.onthecount.org.
TalkBack is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas, heard here Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests, insightful analysis, and, of course, your comments, questions, and observations. That's TalkBack right here on WBAI New York.
Sunana ne Hajiara Matu Ahmed. Ina gaisuwa jama'a gani nan a Wanga Radio WBAI. Wanga Radio za same ta a website wbai.org.
Marhaba, I'm Barbara Nimriyaziz. What are Muslims writing, thinking, doing? What are today's Arabs contributing to civilization? Tahrir on WBAI brings you new voices from your neighborhoods and around the world. Join us Tuesdays, 7 p.m. on listener-sponsored 99.5 FM New York and on the web WBAI.org.
In the afternoon, and this is listener-supported radio WBAI in New York, or we could also say in Nueva York. Howard Jordan here with us. I'm Ibrahim Gonzalez. We'll be here for the next hour celebrating our 50th anniversary. We're speaking with Jim Freund, one of the youngest and yet oldest members of the WBAI family. He got here when he was 13 years old years ago. I'm sorry to out him that way, but he was telling me this is more like celebrating a marriage between WBAI. WBAI stands for Broadcasters Associates Incorporated. That's the, and it's operating since the 40s. And then in 1960, Lou Schweitzer, the owner of the WBAI airwaves on 99.5, donated it to the Pacifica Foundation. So, Howard, ¿qué pasa, brother?
Cuéntame.
Bueno, aquí estamos, uno, tres y pa'lante, sin
well,
miedo.
You know, we got to be celebrating these anniversaries because institutionalized all this experience, collective wisdom in our community. So maybe this afternoon, at least during this 50th commemoration, we could share with some of the WBAI family some of the diversity of the Latino experience and how we all came upon this radio station. Mm-hmm. And a day that will live in infamy? No, not in infamy.
In celebration.
In celebration, right? Maybe talk a little bit about some of the people that have been defining leaders in our own community and what they represent. A long history. One of the things I wanted to try to do today, Bram, is since some of the stuff is archived, and I was trying to explain to Anita Wow that a lot of it we have on audio and has to be transferred. What I did was I tried to dig up some of the interviews that I had with different people in our own community and sort of speak to what their experience has been and what they offered our community. And one of the first people that comes to mind, and Ibrahim, most most people know, is the late Richie Perez.
Mm-hmm.
And Richie was a very special person in our community, and he was a regular WBAI. But one thing Richie represented that I continue to believe is missing in the progressive movement is Richie was a bridge builder. And our communities need bridge builders more now than ever. And in this excerpt that I try to show here on in a tribute that I had to Richie Perez a while back, try to explain to people, maybe people listen to Richie's voice and say some of the things he had to say about where our community was going and his notion of human rights.
Absolutely. During his, the memorial, there were a lot of people that showed up to the memorial that attested to Richie's place in our lives and our hearts, all of the struggles that he helped to spearhead, and many of the ones that he supported as well. Richie Perez, not singularly, but as part of a collective, would make sure that the numbers of grassroots people came out behind different causes. And if it was anything from Attica on through Amadou Diallo through, you know, to the very day that he passed on, he was always active in making sure that the young people were also involved. Richie was a great mentor of young people. In fact, I met Richie when I was 15 years old. He was mentoring the Third World Student.
That's probably when I was about 6.
Tú no te quedas mucho atrás, viejo. And there we were meeting at the Young Lords headquarters on 117th Street and 3rd Avenue. Who was there to guide us through these things? Richie Perez. And it was a young upstart organization underneath the Young Lords called the Third World Student League. And it was that because there were Asians in it, there were progressive white youth in it, there were African Americans, and of course Latinos. And it was an amazing organization to have been a part of as a high school student. And well, Richie Perez was there, you know, providing not only the consciousness raising, but also facilitating what we were able to do.
And maybe if we could at least talk a little with Richie, was also on the forefront of the efforts against police brutality, efforts in Puerto Rico. I worked with Richie in with then the Latino Coalition for Racial Justice, and he had a very broad vision of, though he understood the importance of the Puerto Rican struggle, he was always very inclusive. And he was also very quick to understand the connections with the African-American community. And as Charles Barron, Councilman Barron, once said on my show, he says, I got along with a lot of the activists, but Richie was my heart. You know, so maybe we could hear a little bit of that and sort of...
So you're listening to the 50th anniversary celebration of WBAI as part of the Pacifica Network, and we're going to be highlighting various sheroes and heroes on this edition of the birthday party.
Jordan on the Jordan Journal, and another Friday, and appropriate song from the beginning of this show. The song is called Nadie Es Eterno by Tito Rojas, and it talks about passing of people. Nobody lives forever. And last Saturday, the Puerto Rican community lost one of its primary generals, the People's Struggle. Richie Perez passed away of cancer last Saturday. And for many of us, it was in some ways, the end of a political era. Richie, as many people on the WBAI family know, was a long-time activist in the progressive struggle, many times appeared on this air to talk to people about the different facets of progressive community activism. By his own definition and by many, he was an activist revolutionary who dedicated most of his life social change, to changing people's thinking, changing and tearing down structures that exclude people of color. For many of you who did not know Richie, sounds a bit strange, but you know, I was a bit taken back by how some of the media treated Richie's passing, because it's not a person on BAI, with him and Herson Borrero, who's a journalist, talking about the community and the progressive community. Listen to Richie, and we'll be right back. Leave on us.
I'm here.
Richie?
Yeah. Just a couple of things. You know, every society, however it constructs itself, has to deal with social problems. And so we're in a democratic society, and so we have social problems. But what distinguishes democracy in the dealing with social problems is that we address them and simultaneously pay great attention to people's civil and human rights. If we didn't pay attention to their civil and human rights, we would not be a democracy. We'd be another kind of economic and political system. Like you said before, you know, there was no street crime in Nazi Germany, or the trains ran on time in under Mussolini. You can
I didn't say that, actually.
No, I mean, I'm talking to Howard. In the earlier discussion, somebody mentioned it. One of our tasks and one of the responsibilities of those people who live in a democracy and subscribe to democratic values is to be able to address social problems while at the same time safeguarding the rights of the people of that nation. And this is not being done to my satisfaction, and I think to the satisfaction of many other people, that we have to address these problems. Is not what we're arguing about. Yes, absolutely, we have to address problems. Organized crime, including white-collar crime, you know, drunken driving, you know, violence in the streets, drug dealing, etc. Those are problems that have to be addressed. But it is wrong to tell people that in order to address those problems, they have to give up their civil and constitutional rights. I don't want to live in that kind of society.
And if I can add a point to what you were saying, see, I think there's a mistake when you call what you don't mind going through. And
you were listening there to Richie Perez, and I thought it was a fitting tribute and recognition as we embark on the 50th anniversary and we celebrate Richie, who has joined the ancestors, what he did and how he touched so many lives. One of the groups that was we discussed about, and we commemorate the 50th anniversary of BAI, is the Young Lords. And I wanted to share with some of you part of an interview that I did at one point with Mickey Melendez, and he did a book called We Took the Streets, and he tried to chronicle some of the accomplishments of the Young Lords. And I thought it'd be interesting at least to listen to Mickey talk about the takeover of a very important church in the Puerto Rican community, as the Puerto Rican nouveau middle class and the Puerto Rican generation born here became integral players in the struggle for social change. Listen to Mickey Melendez and We Took the Streets.
The First Spanish Methodist Church, and for a lot of people,
in East Harlem and in New York City, that became very much a historical reference point. That church became the operating center of the Young Lords, where the Young Lords, what some of us who teach history teach as the first expression of the Fiesta Boricua in U.S.-born Puerto Ricans in New York. Talk about that church. I know you took it over twice.
Right.
Why the takeover of the church? Why at one point the hostility over the apparent, you know, point you put in your book, you talk about somebody was killed by the police.
That was
the second time
we took it over,
and
right.
You sort of came in, and this time you were packing guns, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, why that church and why that particular place in East Harlem?
Well, after the garbage offensive, you know, the idea, and again, you know, this was an evolution that was taking place. You know, the level of nationalism in El Barrio was not because of the Young Lords, and it was not because of this group was there. It was a natural evolution that was taking place, you know, among the masses of people. Because again, although we live in El Barrio, we don't live in isolation of what was going on in the world. And again, the war in Vietnam, the civil rights movement, the national, the movement of other national minorities. So there was already a feeling, a nationalist feeling. I think what we were able to do was get galvanize it and channel it in the right direction. So that after the garbage offensive, we had, you know, I would say hundreds of people coming to us, and, you know, young people just like us wanted to give up their lives because it was, you know, it was a 7:24 or 7 whatever. Back then it was 25 hours a day. You were a Young Lord 25 hours a day.
24/7, yeah.
24/7, right. Back then it was, you know, you were a Young Lord 25 hours a day, you know. We thought we were so cool we even added an hour. So we developed an educational program, and if you wanted to become close to the Young Lords, you started off as a friend of the Lords, and based on your commitment, and after we checked you out, and things like that.
And you have required reading, right? You require reading with what?
Required reading with things like the,
French Fanon,
Che Guevara, the Red Book.
Mao.
We were very Maoist. And then, you know, eventually you became a Lord in training, and eventually you became a Young Lord. You were assigned to a ministry, and then you did work there. You know, we looked at this place in our community that was only open 2 or 3 hours a week, you know, and we were kind of a little jealous because national headquarters in Chicago was kind of, you know, housed in a church, you know. And, I mean, the other part of it was that, you know, okay, it's a Christian church. You know, I mean, isn't this the Christian, you know, mantra, you know, to serve, to give, you know, to help, you know, the down and the drawn. And we went, and I think the unfortunate piece of this was that the pastor of the church had just come from Cuba. So what he was fleeing Cuba about, he found in us. You know, at that time we had long hair.
So you all
we even had hair at the time. We had we were berets.
You were little Fidelista.
Exactly. Absolutely. You know, so he's running from Cuba, and he finds us in his church every Sunday, you know, trying to negotiate some space. But the space was for a clothing program, was to open up a health clinic, because we had been doing lead poison and TB testing with Mount Sinai and progressive doctors. And, you know, 3, 4, 5 weeks, you know, it was no. You know, the cops get called in. Felipe gets his head broken, 13 stitches, rather, his arm broken. And the following week, we took over the church, and we put all those programs in the church. We established a free health program. We established a clothing drive. We established cultural events. For many of us, it was the first time we saw Pedro Petri. Ironically enough, Pedro Petri's family was the largest family in that church. But Pedro had gone to Vietnam and came back totally freaked out, and it pushed all these creative buttons in him. And, you know, I call him, I think rightfully so, he's the poet laureate of our generation. So we took over space and we demonstrated, you know, what we could do with space, you know, and there were 200, 300 people in this building every single day. 106 people got busted when the bust eventually came down.
That's important people understand that, you know, because you got some younger folks that don't understand the context of this time. At this time, Puerto Ricans are totally excluded from everything that's mainstream in New York City. You got to think of it as comparing it to a segregation era in some ways in terms of how our communities perceive.
Right.
Because you tell some of the young folks, they think, nah, because they got bilingual ed, I teach at all stuff. You get, people think they took it, they thought that is given. You people were on the front lines of a battle that, by most standards, the broader society had no appreciation for what it was to be Puerto Rican.
Even to demonstrate our flag. You know, I mean, I look at cars now and I see the Puerto Rican flag on the visors, and it's not just an air freshener. It's a real flag that's there, you know. And you know, people take that as a given, you know. I mean, it was nice to see 2 or 3 years after the Young Lords, young people younger than us, people in, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old, putting the Puerto Rican flag on their jeans. totally unheard of, you know? It was this issue about being proud. It was about this issue of embracing. And one of the things that we did, because part of our political education, and I think that Ed Morales does this in this book called Living in Spanglish, where he looks at that period of time and he talks about the Young Lords, and he says that the Young Lords, like no other generation before them, I mean, we really looked at our history and we embraced, again, it was part of moving away from the Eurocentric ideology. We embraced our African culture, we embraced our indigenous culture in a way that nobody had up until that point. And that was part of our own.
Te pedido perdón.
You were listening to Mickey Melendez and his book, We Took the Street, in an interview I did with Mickey. I think it was 2004. Como pasan los años, huh?
Has it been that long?
We're getting better, but not younger.
The books are still on the shelves, and I would recommend that the young people, the old people alike, read the book. It's a very important part of history of our struggle here as Puerto Ricans in New York City and the United States from a New Yorican perspective.
Somebody got to tell our story, and the next person you're going to be listening to, and I'm trying to cover this Young Lord era, and I know we got limited for time, but let's listen to Felipe Luciano. I had a Felipe on a while back, and he tells a little bit about his story. As many people know, Felipe is a celebrity and a personality in our community. We love him, we hate him, we love to hate him, all kinds of stuff. But
sometimes hate to love him, but we embrace all of our people under the rainbow. And one thing about Felipe is that he does know how to get a point across, no doubt.
And listen to him now and you see what Ibrahim means.
In Madison Avenue. That's right across the street from the Foster Project. This was down home heavy stuff. The Viceroys had to fight. We had a group called the Viceroys in New York City. Family, let me explain this to you. When we first came here, Puerto Ricans had to pass. Some of us passed as white. We did. Some of us got jobs as doormen because we looked Irish, we looked Jewish, we looked Turkish, we looked Egyptian. You know how that is. Black Puerto Ricans have always been black, so they just were black. They had to deal with what they had to deal with. By the way, they suffered the same socioeconomic stresses that all black people did, though they spoke Spanish. Having said that, my grandfather Pepe, if you called him black, he would say, oh, espérate un minuto. Espérate un minuto. Wait just a minute. I know black. I know black. I know colored, because in those days it was colored. Because the Spanish had taught him that one drop of white blood made him white. And of course, any Puerto Rican can point to someone who has straight hair, una nariz perfila. We all got that, man. Ain't nothing new. Black people take notice, those who are you listening, because this same thing happened to black people. It gets me mad when black people say, oh, that didn't happen among us. You a damn liar. We had brown paper bags tests. You had to pass the brown paper bag test. They didn't have a black model in ebony till the 80s, till the 90s, damn near. We love light-skinned people. Black folks love light-skinned. This is nothing new. So we've been running this game on each other for a long time. Here's the deal. You come to 1945 was a seminal point. Everybody comes to Harlem, and the Viceroys are fighting, the Tiny Tots on it, the chaplains in Brooklyn. But because of the common enemy, which was institutionalized racism, we had to come together. I used to jitterbug with a group called the Canarsie Chaplains. These cats lived on the Brookline Projects. Brookline Projects was the gulag, Howard. You didn't apply for the Brookline. You got exiled there. That's how deep that was. So when you had Puerto Ricans and black people exiled and having to depend on each other, it wasn't a question. I mean, ese cocoro no va a cuidar a mi niña. That Negro is not going to take care of my child. Do you know how many black mothers I know took care of Puerto Rican children? Do you know how many black children I know were taken care of by Puerto Rican mothers because their mothers couldn't afford daycare? And these cats eat rice and beans con tocino. They may be Muslim now, but they eat pork. Went out with Puerto Rican women, are married to Puerto Rican, married, divorced, and married again. Got 5 grandkids. No, man. We've been at this for, and to this day, that unity between us is so strong. It's thicker than any city I've seen. I've been to Philadelphia. I've been to Florida, to Miami. I've been to L.A., where we got a group of people called Blaxicans.
that's Felipe Luciano and giving you a taste of some of that.
AKA vision, Radio Bemba.
Yeah, Ibrahim, I know you want to talk about that pork thing, but let's...
Well, you know, no pork on my fork ever since I became Muslim back in 1973. But Felipe's brother was Muslim also, lucky. Oh. And he belonged to a very integral mosque in Harlem, Mosque of Islamic Brotherhood. And the mix between Puerto Ricanos and African Americans in our neighborhoods led to a lot of cross-pollinization. And yeah, he was right about, you know, that mix of flavors. I know a lot of, you know, African Americans that used to learn how to Latin. They loved dancing to the music. I mean, it's their roots as well as the roots of Caribbean and Antillanos, because the roots are in Africa.
We're going to take this city soon. Let's move on to the other side.
We have it surrounded, Howard.
Yeah, or they have us surrounded, one or the other.
Who's next?
Who's next? Listen to Gerardo Rivera with the lawyer from the Young Lords. And I recently, a while back, interviewed Gerardo about his book, Hispanic. And he speaks to the fear people have of the Hispanic population from a very different perspective than Felipe, but there showed you how diverse the mix was.
This is WBAI celebrating 50 years with Pacifica.
Book about Hispanics.
Well, you know, that night with O'Reilly was really the catalyst. I had been the kind of minority voice here at Fox News. I mean, in the literal majority minority numerical way, aside from my skin color, on the issue of immigration for some months. And what it seemed to me was that what Bill was doing and what others, principally Lou Dobbs and Sean Hannity, were doing is really scapegoating immigrants, principally Latino immigrants, and blaming them for everything from crime to disease to terrorism to the bad economy. It really, you know, irked me because I knew scapegoating when I saw it, and I just wanted to stand up for this most vulnerable portion of our society.
Gerardo, what do you say? There's a lot of people that I know you've gotten a lot of hate mail over this and
amazing,
all kinds of stuff.
Amazing.
And what do you say to people? You know, there's a lot of fear in America, and people are saying, "Well, look, you know, these people are taking our jobs." And some people feel that it's almost like a coded way of attacking Hispanics.
I think it is a coded way of attacking Hispanics, because every study that I've seen shows that, you know, who's the guys that get laid off in Merrill Lynch, they're not going to go pick the blueberries in the fields of Michigan. You know, the reason they're moving, the so-called illegal immigrants are moving into the towns throughout the South, the Old South, is that the old poultry packing plants, processing plants have been abandoned by local residents. Nobody wants that awful job. The meat packing industry in the Midwest, it's a horrible job compared to the pay you get. The fields of the Great Southwest and the desert there and the ranches, they're very hard jobs. And the reason the undocumented workers have been lured here, Howard, over the years is the promise of lax border enforcement, plus they could get a job when they got here. And then all of a sudden 9/11 happened, and you know, all of a sudden the hammer didn't fall on the people who perpetrated the terrible deed downtown. It fell on the Mexican border with enforced, you know, enhanced enforcement and politicians screaming that they should make felons of these poor, hard-working people. You know, guys coming here to deliver pizzas or to put some nails in a roof or to wash a dish or a woman to take care of a baby. It's you know, these are essentially good people. Every study that I've seen shows they're less likely to commit crimes than citizens are, and it's just, you know, it's one of those times in American history. It's happened before. It happened to the Irish in the middle of the 19th century. It happened to the Italians, the Germans, the Europeans.
That was Gerardo Rivera and his talking about his book, Hispanic, and as many people know, he was one of the lawyers for Young Lords. And it just shows you how diverse this young group of revolutionaries were at the time. But not all was perfect in the world of radicalism and Puerto Rican radicalism at that time. And as many people know, I wanted to share with you an interview I did with Erica Gonzalez and Esperanza Martela on the... Erica had just written an article in Color Lines about the sexism within the Young Lords and some of the weaknesses that the movement experienced as a result. Let's listen to Erica Gonzalez talk about sexism and the Young Lords.
I'm trying to figure out whether some of it is revisionist or not. To what extent was sexism an integral part of the earlier movement? Has that evolved and changed? There was the anniversary of the Young Lords, 40th anniversary on Sunday. What did you discover in your piece?
Well, I think what was obvious in, or became obvious in the story is sort of the lasting impact of women who challenged a status quo within an organization committed to progressive change. And the reality is that sexism, you know, trickles down, you know, to every one of us, subtly and directly, and machismo, and that this was evident in the Young Lords Party. The thing that Connie Cruz points out that I mentioned in the article is that through her experience in the Young Lords, through a personal interaction, where, you know, she became interested in going to the People's Church, and her brother-in-law basically tells her, oh, no, esto es una cosa para hombre, you know. And she says, no, this sounds like a cause I would be interested in. So maybe it was a conversion of being oriented to follow her family, to follow her then partner, and just this being told that she couldn't be present and at an activity that was of interest to her. All of those converge to being in the actual People's Church. All of those things actually converge to help her raise her voice. And that means that in the context of a relationship, that may sound like something basic and may sound like something that people take for granted. But the reality is, especially if you're looking at the 60s and 50s culture, is that there were strict definitions about what a woman could or couldn't do. And so, you know, as Iris points out in the piece, that was a revolutionary act to kind of assert your voice and to claim it and then to proceed forward on it. So I think that there were many ways that women and men were touched in the party and were able to transform themselves. And of course, as you have in other organizations and other settings, there are people who don't transform themselves. There are people who don't get the message. And, you know, that's sad, you know, but I think that there were a lot of people who understood that the interpersonal behavior counted. That
was Erica Gonzalez, and she's speaking about sexism in the Young Lords. She was making reference to Iris Morales, who's an attorney and a film director. She did the film Palante, and she had the whole history. She was an integral part of the Young Lords. And pretty soon, I suspect a lot of the women in the Lords will also share a different view of the Young Lords experience. But now we're going to move a little bit, since we are talking about the 50th anniversary of WBAI. There was another group that characterized the 60s and the 70s, and it was the Puerto Rican Socialist Party.
El PSP. Formerly known as the Movimiento Pro Independencia.
That's right. And a lot of those folks came from Puerto Rico. They came here. There was always a slight tension between the Young Lord and the PSP.
Why do you think that was?
Well, if you hear the Young Lords side, as Felipe said, that was, quote, very white of them. So, you know, there was this sense from the Young Lords side that they were a very elitist group of folks that were part of that Hispanophile elite out of Puerto Rico, and they wanted to tell the New Yorkian community here what to do on the Young Lords side. But on their side, one thing that the PSP did bring, it was the internationalization of the status of Puerto Rico. And as we'll listen to this cut off from Jose Velasquez, who wrote the book The Puerto Rican Movement along with Andy Torres, they speak about Juan Mari Bras, and they talk about the internationalization of the struggle against decolonization. And in retrospect, for those who look back on this, BAI captured all of this. But what it essentially, each group there bears a certain amount of recognition for what they contributed to the struggle. The Young Lords were grassroots. That Young Lords were the first to talk about our Afro-Latino experience. They came out of our barrios. The PSP was probably a lot more upwardly mobile, light up. But the other side of it, they were able to touch base in the international community. And when Juan Mari Blas used to go to Cuba, he was recognized.
Also, the intellectual aspect of what Pesepe did, the high level of political discussion that took place in Puerto Rico, plus the legacy of struggle that was passed on to them all the way from the, I guess, Anacaona through Betances, on through Don Pedro Albizu Campos, Lolita Lebron. They were part of that dialogue. They were the continuity of our home-based, our island-based struggle.
And the crown achievement for them, if people remember the Bicentennials Without Colonies in Madison Square Garden that brought 20,000 people out there. I was that day. I was sad to hear Geraldo booed that day. I told Geraldo. But many of us had a very different view at that time. And in this piece, Jose Velázquez, who is the author of the anthology, The Puerto Rican Movement, along with Andy Torres, speaks to Juan Mari Bras, the documentary Juan Mari Bras, and it talks about the first citizen of Puerto Rico, and we'll hear what that means.
This Saturday, January 14th, at 6 p.m., at Hostos Community College, we're going to have a premiere of the documentary called Juan Mari Bras, Puerto Ricano Indocumentado, or a undocumented Puerto Rican. Many people in the United States may, especially those on the left, remember Juan Mari Bras as one of the keynote speakers in the 1974 activity of Madison Square Garden in solidarity with the independence of Puerto Rico. Juan Mari Bras is probably it reflects the what we call the new struggle for independence, which began after the World War II and began in the 50s, and it continues all the way to the present. And he's probably one of the most respected figures, one of the most feared figures in Puerto Rican politics, known nationally in the United States as well as internationally because of his presence at the United Nations and in third world organizations, Committee of Non-Aligned Nations. So he's one of the most respected figures of the Puerto Rican independence movement.
Now he's got a long history. We interviewed him a while back on the Jordan Journal. And I know his roots go back to the Movimiento Pro Independence, the MPI, and then at one point he became the head of the Puerto Rican Socialist Party. And recently he was honored by the, strangely enough, the city council, Puerto Rican legislator of the city council as the first Puerto Rican citizen. Can you give some background to the WBAI family? How does this man who comes out of the Puerto Rican left, who's recognized in the international community, end up becoming the first Puerto Rican citizen and, as the documentary tells us, the first undocumented Puerto Rican?
That's right, Howard. And you were clearly pointing out that Puerto Ricans are United States citizens by force. The Jones Act of 1917, which was actually rejected by the local Puerto Rican legislature, gave Puerto Ricans no choice as to U.S. citizenship. Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens since 1917. However, this has been something that has been challenged by the Puerto Rican independence movement historically. The fact that we are Puerto Rican citizens and that the Puerto Rican people wanted to have their own citizenship, the Puerto Rican citizenship. Now, of course, this creates a dilemma for the United States Congress in relationship to their laws. Now, what happened was that Juan Mari Bras actually took the initiative along with hundreds of others. He may be the one who's most known, but hundreds of Puerto Ricans over the last couple of decades have actually rejected their United States citizenship. Now, the law is very interesting because the law calls for if you reject your United States citizenship, then you should be deported back to the country of origin. Now, in this case, your country of origin is Puerto Rico, which created
which is part of the United States.
Which is part of the United States territory and the United States control, and it created an incredible controversy and dilemma for the State Department and for the United States government, because Juan Mari Bras challenged them to, okay, well then, deport me back to my country of origin and let me have my Puerto Rican citizenship, let me be able to travel with a Puerto Rican passport, with be able to vote in local elections, and it just raised the whole issue of colonial relationship between the United States and Puerto Rico. interestingly enough, the State Department actually refused to process the deportation or the taking away of his citizenship because of the dilemma that it creates for.
No, let me. We're listening there to Jose Velasquez. He's one of the authors of the Puerto Rican Movement. They're talking about the documentary One Mari Bras. And the first citizen of Puerto Rico, as he indicated, Mari Bras renounced American citizenship. And as a result, under immigration law, you get sent back to your country of origin. But he got sent back to Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is part of the United States. Is there a Puerto Rican citizenship independent of American citizenship? Now, so that we don't get accused of leaving out the politicians as we commemorate the 50th anniversary.
And we have our favorites.
We have some that are a little more acceptable than others, even though I make a routine, and Ibrahim, you do too, of cutting some of these guys up. I did have an interview at one point with Congressman Jose Serrano, and as many people know, he's part of the liberal left wing of the U.S. Congress, and some people would have liked to see Serrano run for mayor or something else, but I guess... being too far on the left and aging elected official, I think he's settled for being in Congress, and maybe we need him there at this point.
Listen to this interview. Which committee is he on?
Appropriations.
Yeah.
And here he talks about why Puerto Rico doesn't receive the same status as Cuba in the progressive community. Listen to Congressman Jose Serrano.
Celebrating 50 years as part of Pacifica, WBAI, in Nueva York.
The question of Puerto Rico, America's last colony, receives.
It's amazing. You know, you've hit on one of my favorite, saddest subjects. Favorite because I think about it a lot. Saddest because I just don't know why it continues to be the same way. The ignorance of the American public towards the issue of Puerto Rico, and I say ignorance in quotes, it's not a put down on anybody. The lack of information of members of Congress. I tell two very sad and interesting stories all the time. Some years ago, a very prominent New York elected official who is still in public office in New York, and out of respect to him, we won't mention his name, in the 1980s went to my father's funeral and asked me why next to the Puerto Rican flag was the American flag on my father's casket. And I said to him, because he served in the Army and he wanted it that way. And the fellow walks away and says, oh, that's great. And he comes back later to me and he says, you know, I just learned something today. And I said, why? He says, I did not know that the Puerto Rican Army uses the American flag. Now, on another occasion, I had another prominent member of Congress say, Joe, next time you go to Puerto Rico, could you give me coins and currency for my collection? And so I stuck my hand in my pocket and gave him a dollar and a quarter. And I think I made the point, and he was somewhat embarrassed. But, you know, I laughed about it because that's the sadness. In fact, in yesterday's Olympic victory, and I want to be careful here because I know what station I'm on, and I don't want people to think I'm making a pro-statehood statement. But did anybody notice that the team that defeated, quote-unquote, the Americans was composed of American citizens?
Wow.
Not once did anyone mention that. In other words, it was like these foreigners were beating the heck out of the Americans. And you read AP, and I purposely did a search, AP, ESPN, CNN, everybody talks about this group of people beat the Americans. Well, whether we feel nationalistic or not about it, which I do and you do, and it's a wonderful victory, the fact of life, technically, it was that it was a team made of American citizens defeating another team of American citizens. And no one noticed because people don't know.
Congressman, it's almost like I was making the same observation. It's almost like this double consciousness that America seems to have. It's like we're insiders and outsiders at the very same time.
Exactly. That's the best way to phrase it. We are insiders, but we're outsiders. And again...
That's Congressman Serrano talking about Puerto Ricans as
insiders and what Juan Gonzalez calls citizen foreigners.
Or it's political schizophrenia.
Yeah, that's right. And people still don't know who we are. They're still trying to figure out who and what we are as a people.
We're still trying to figure it out.
Yeah, but they're not hoping. They're not hoping, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Segueing into, that was Congressman Serrano, and we're going to be, one of the people I interviewed, and I think it's a very important people recognize, there's been four generations of Puerto Rican political prisoners in the United States, and I interviewed a while back, Dilcia Pagan, and the next excerpt you're going to hear is an interview with Dilcia Pagan talking about Puerto Rican political prisoners, who are they, and why it's so important. As I call it, the Puerto Rican political prisoners are the torchbearers of the Puerto Rican nationality. And listen to Dilcia explain what it is to spend 20 years in prison for people.
They think that everybody that's in prison has committed some major crime. Can you explain to the WBI family what is a Puerto Rican political prisoner and how that distinguishes itself from the countless other people that are also in prisons as well? And also, you define yourself as a prisoner of war. Maybe you can explain that as well.
Definitely. Well, a political prisoner, a Puerto Rican political prisoner, is a person who has been captured and arrested by the enemy, which is the United States government, really, by your oppressing force, which is today has been the United States since 1898, and is charged for a political act. I, inclusive of the nationalists, of Don Pedro, every Puerto Rican that has served time, federal time in the United States, has been charged with seditious conspiracy, which is Part D of the law of treason. And seditious conspiracy states that we were involved, we were conspiring to overthrow the United States government by force, which to me is an honor. But the irony is that the only people that were given the sentences like we received, and the nationalists, and Don Pedro, Juan Antonio Correa, Clemente Soto Velez, and the list goes on and on, are people were given sentences from 35 to 110 years. And during my lifetime, there were people from the Aryan Nation, which are white supremacists, that were charged with seditious conspiracy, and they were given 2 years probation. Well, Lolita, Rafael, Irving, Oscar served 25 and a half years. I and my comrades, Carmen Valentin, Alicia Lucy Rodriguez, you know, Elizan Escobar, Ricardo Jimenez, Luis Rosa, Edwin Cortez, served 20, and Roberto, I'm sorry, the two, Alejandrina Torres and Alfredo Rodriguez, we served 20 years. Today, we have two compañeros, Carlos Alberto Torres, who has been incarcerated now 26 years, and Oscar Lopez Rivera, who's been incarcerated 25 years, for the only reason of wanting our nation to be free and self-sovereign.
Now, you've done, after you got out from serving, you were formerly a filmmaker of some kind.
You were listening to Dilcia Pagan explain what is a Puerto Rican political prisoner, and we're celebrating 50 years of freedom. Free Speech Radio, WBAI, as part of the Pacifica Network. It's now 2:47 in the afternoon. Howard Jordan has assembled an incredible amount of a vocal scape, a collage of various people within our communities. And now we go to La República Dominicana. Dominicans have taken a great part in Latino politics in New York.
You know, Ibrahim, one of the things I say is there's an emergent Latino identity in the United States, and Puerto Ricans are caught somewhere in that discussion. I think sometimes we're in and sometimes we're not even there. We're not immigrants, we're migrants. We're U.S. citizens at birth, and we still got to work out this special intra-Latino family relationship. But, you know, los dominicanos son nuestros primos hermanos. And I think my interview here with Moisés Perez from Alianza Dominicana begins to talk about the realities of the Dominican Republic. Many of the people that keep the Dominicans who sneak into Puerto Rico hidden are the Puerto Rican people themselves. So there's a long history going back there. I happen to think, you know, the biggest immigration advocates of Puerto Ricans, including Luis Gutierrez, Congressman Gutierrez, who just introduced the immigration bill floating in Congress. Listen to Moisés Perez talk about Alianza Dominicana and the Dominican experience.
WBAI en Nueva York.
This is Howard Jordan on the Jordan Journal, and I'm joined by Moisés Pérez, who's the executive director of Alianza Dominicana, Dominican Alliance, the biggest social service agency in the Dominican community, possibly in New York City, one of the biggest. Welcome to the show, Moisés.
Hey, how are you?
Moisés, let's discuss Dominican reality. Now, I've been hearing a lot of people telling me about the bad conditions in the Dominican Republic. The economy is having some serious problems. Yet you run an agency that services largely Dominican population, and the Dominican community in New York and the United States seems to be coming of age. How would you juxtapose those two realities?
Well, they're very close, actually, one to the other, because while there is a tremendous plight right now in the Dominican Republic, just to give you an idea, according to the United States Coast Guard, in January of this year, there were more interceptions of individuals in those little boat people trying to make their way to Puerto Rico from the Dominican Republic, a total of about 1,500 individuals, than the entire year of 2003. So the recent economic situation in the Dominican Republic is obviously driving lots of people, you know, out of the country, and people are absolutely desperate. They were probably waiting for the holidays to be over to make that, you know, journey. And that includes about roughly anywhere from 30 to 50 individuals who died, you know, trying to make that journey. On the other hand, we find that here in the United States, while the Dominican community is progressing and moving along, we're still among the poorest of communities in the United States. Our family income is low. We have a high rate of young people who drop out of school. The good news, we also have a lot of young people who are going to college. We have a very large number of individuals who don't have health insurance, who are still subjected to some of the poorest paying jobs with the least benefits. So while the Dominican community in the United States is relatively better off than the majority of Dominicans, say, in the Dominican Republic, vis-a-vis the standards in the United States, our community is in real trouble.
Now, to some observers, right, they'll look back and they'll say, well, look, yeah, this is a rite of passage in America. Right, immigrant groups come in, they move up the totem pole, they become successful, then a new group of immigrants comes in. And a lot of people are seeing, you know, high profile. For example, I think there are now 4 Dominican elected officials, or 5, 4, I think it is. You see large interest in terms of Dominican merchants playing a primary role in a lot of the city's economy. How do you view that? Is that more of a middle class phenomenon? And to what extent did that seep into the statistics you talk about, the poverty, the misery index?
There is a growing, actually, the Dominican...
You're listening to Moisés Pérez from Alianza Dominicana. There was an interview I did, I think it was 2004, too. Some of those are pretty old interviews. I just want to give you a flavor of the voices that WBAI has permitted myself and many others to bring to the public, voices that you would not ordinarily hear. You're going to hear now Juan Flores, who's... prominent Puerto Rican intellectual, and he's written a book called The Diaspora Strikes Back. And he talks about that, and he also talks about the Afro-Latino experience. As many people know, Juan and Miriam Jimenez have headed up the Afro-Latino Forum, as has Malta Vega created the Caribbean Cultural Center, as Latinos explore their African roots and move away from denial and toward recognition of who and what we are. Juan Flores.
Well, I think that's kind of the drift of what I'm saying. I always qualify it by saying that some of the baggage that goes back is not that liberating. It's pretty oppressive, the kind of arrogance of being from the big country and you know, those kind of put-down attitudes among some. You know, I'd say that definitely takes place. And then some of the, you know, some kind of materialistic values that undermine some of the more traditional senses of community and so forth that were very deep and are very deep in Puerto Rican and Dominican culture. So we have to, I always try to be careful not to say this is the whole picture and nothing sort of negative is happening, nothing even more reactionary and kind of imperialist is happening as a result of these flows and transfers and returns and remittances. You know, but I think what's been ignored or not enough attention has been paid to those liberating qualities, to bringing back a sense of pride in blackness and pride in African background, and challenging a Eurocentric kind of perspective and challenging the way in which at times the indigenous is taken as a cover for the black and is taken for an evasion of an affirmation of blackness being the solid column of Puerto Rican and Dominican and Cuban cultures. They're the basis, the strongest footing of the cultures on those islands and in many parts of the of Afro-Latin America that have, of course, been denied for centuries now.
That's Juan Flores, as many people know. Juan Flores is one of the premier Puerto Rican intellectuals in the country, and he's also speaking there about his book, The Diaspora Strikes Back, but he's been a very strong intellectual presence along with Miriam Jimenez on the issue of Afro-Latinos, as well as my sister, Marta Vega. Now we're going to hear a little bit about the Chicano history, and maybe people in the Northeast are on top of the Chicano, and people better get hip, because 6 out of every 10 Latinos in the United States are of Mexican origin. So I salute my Mexican brothers. We should never be afraid of other communities' empowerment, and like I said, this emerging Latino identity still has to work itself out in these 47 million people. But listen to Rudy Acuña, who wrote a book called Occupied America, which is a seminal work, and Alanis, who wrote a book called Viva la Raza, and they're talking about the Chicano experience in the United States. By two guests, Rudy Acuña, who is a historian professor and one of the foremost scholars on Chicano studies. Mr. Acuña is the author of the seminal work, Chicano History, Occupied America, History of Chicanos. His most recent book is Voices of the U.S. Latino Experience, a three-volume collection that showcases more than 400 primary documents from concerning Latino groups in the United States. And welcome to the show, Rudy.
Thank you very much.
And Yolanda Alanis, she's a Los Angeles Chicana feminist and a former California State University Northridge assistant archivist and co-author of a new book entitled Viva la Raza, A History of Chicano Identity and Resistance. Welcome to the show, Yolanda.
Thank you very much.
Well, maybe first, Rudy, as the historian in the group, maybe you could give our listeners a 101 primer on, first, maybe definitions. What is defined as being a Chicano for those of the Northeast experience especially, and maybe a little bit of how the origins of where the Chicano experience became prominent?
Well, the word Chicano is really a political term, and it refers to primarily people of Mexican origin in the Southwest. It varies because many times other groups are included within that definition when they are political. Chicano history begins with people of Mexican origin in the United States, and it begins with the U.S. invasions in 1836 and 1848 when the United States robbed about 55% of Mexico's land from it.
Now, when you talk about the Chicano, can you make the segue from how they are? Is Mexican American and Chicano interchangeable, or they are a different term?
It's interchangeable, yes.
And give us the sense of the flavor. We wish we could give you a little more of that, but we're limited by time. Ibrahim will tell you. We got one more person on there, and it's Laura Pulido, who wrote a book, Black, Brown, and Red and Beyond, if I remember the title. And it speaks to how these communities of color relate to one another and the what people have come to call the intersectionalities of oppressed people. And she wrote a book, and she talks about the different ethnic communities in the United States and where they're similar and where they're different. I think there's a lot of need for more scholarship in this area. And listen to her speak about why she was motivated to write this book. Laura Pulido.
Because of different types of we experience in different kinds of ways, perhaps based on our economic position, based on our language, based on our citizenship, based on our histories here in this country. And I guess I really became very interested in this idea because so often I would hear people talk about racism as if there's only one form of racism. And certainly there's many forms of racism, and the racism that I may experience as a Chicana may be very different than that experienced by my, for example, my Japanese-American partner, or something like that. So I kind of really wanted to shed light on those differences that exists and how we experience racism.
So, for example, how would an African-American maybe experience a racialization different than either somebody that might be Asian or Latino?
Good question. Like, and I think there are also very kind of a lot of geographic specificity here, so I will talk about Los Angeles. A good comparison, for example, would be like with an African-American man, okay? People see an African-American man right away. Certain thoughts might go through people's head. Oh, God, got to hold on to my purse. Potential criminal here, right? Probably lazy. Who knows, you know, what kind of stuff this man's into. People see me. They don't think of those things. I tend to be invisible. Okay, I'm a very small brown female. I don't ever pose a threat. I'm actually just a burden on society.
Either that or welfare queen, depending.
Exactly. So it's a very different kind of racialization, right? They're both very powerful. They're both very dangerous and debilitating, but they're very different.
And does that...
Well, Howard, it was a quick hour, let me tell you. We're celebrating 50 years with the Pacifica Network. That marriage, it's the 50th anniversary. And this has been a special edition in between the mix, everything that has been going over the airwaves to remind everybody what Pacifica is all about here in New York City. WBAI, a place that's a rabble-rousing place on the FM dial, a place where people have the forum and the exchange of ideas, where arts, culture, public affairs, news is all celebrated. And Howard, tell the people when you're on the air, so that way those people that are used to listening to Radio Libre on a Sunday afternoon know when you're on the air.
Well, I'm on Friday from 5 to 6, and you can listen to some of these interviews, the more recent ones, on Fridays. I try to give people a cross-section of a little taste of everything. I always appreciate that, in fact, WBAI has given people like me access to be able to share some of these Latino voices in our community. And the voices are many. I couldn't cover them all. I suspect some of you are saying, why did he pick so-and-so and why did he not pick so-and-so? One thing we've got to recognize is that WBAI has given a diverse number of voices the right to say and speak what they... We don't always agree, by the way, but it's important that those voices be heard, and nothing could be truer to the mission of a WBAI than some of these voices. And I also would like to mention we have Anita Antonetti in studio here, the daughter of Evelina Antonetti, who has joined us as well in studio. So again, we commemorate WBAI, we recognize it's the 50th anniversary, celebrate and recognize that something very special takes place on your 50th anniversary, and it's a tribute to the progressive community and a renewal of mission. And part of our new mission, in my judgment, Ibrahim, is to bring together people of color, have them understand each other's realities as a way of fomenting a new progressive movement in the United States. And hopefully we are part of that, and the people that you've been hearing or they are part of that as well.
Part of the Pacifica mission is to bring different people together for a wider, a broader understanding of each other's cultures, contrasting of political viewpoints. And it's not the choir just singing to itself. It has to engage all of the different political spectrums that there are, challenge all of the different points of views that we have within our community. And out of that struggle, out of that dialogue, can come the effective ideas that we need to make a difference in our communities and throughout our global village. Our lunch today, it was provided by the Subway Sandwich Shop. Thank you very much, right here on 122 Water Street. So thank you so much to the owner of that particular sandwich shop, the Subway Sandwich Shop, Fethi. Let me see if I can get this. Hassau, okay? So thank you very much, Fethi Hassau, over at the sandwich shop. I think I'm just about hungry enough for a little bite. What about you, Howard? You
I'm
you
trying not to, but I, you know, leave me not into temptation, but okay, I have to try something.
So we not only thank you, we encourage our listenership to visit the store as well. Someone right there, that man and that staff that's supporting what we do here on Pacifica Radio, WBAI. And, well, we're getting ready to shift gears here. I'm imagining that the next people that are up are coming into the studio. Kathy Davis here. And I'm Ibrahim Gonzalez.
This is Howard Jordan.
And until the next time, stay strong. And as we say in the Bronx, go hello con take it easy. Assalamu alaikum.
God loves you, and I do too.
da un nuevo futuro y una oportunidad. Pero ya que estamos lejos de nuestro suelo natal, luchemos por el encuentro con nuestra propia verdad. Debajo de
tonight is to focus your attention on this little group of men who not only enjoy a right of instant rebuttal to every presidential address, but more importantly, wield a free hand in selecting, presenting, and interpreting the great issues in our nation. The American people would rightly not tolerate this concentration of power in government. Is it not fair and relevant to question its concentration in the hands of a tiny, enclosed fraternity of privileged men elected by no one and enjoying a monopoly sanctioned and licensed by government? As with other American institutions, perhaps it is time that the networks were made more responsive to the views of the nation and more responsible to the people they serve. Now, a virtual monopoly of a whole medium of communication is not something that democratic people should blithely ignore. And we are not going to cut off our television sets and listen to the phonograph just because the airways belong to the networks. They don't. They belong to the people. The great networks have dominated America's airways for decades. The people are entitled to a full accounting of their stewardship.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Mendel Rivers to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised.
Network Project is a collective research and action group formed last year to investigate network broadcasting and to get people to think seriously about the present system of communications and how it affects their lives. It is dedicated to the principle of feedback, of setting up the missing line of communications from receiver back to sender. This program, the second in a series, is an examination of broadcasting as an industry.
The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nubs. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner. The revolution will not be televised, brother.
The electromagnetic spectrum over which broadcasts are transmitted is a limited resource. Its limitations have been compounded, however, by the development of a national network triopoly of control. The broadcast industry was an adjunct to the manufacture and distribution of the television product. From the first, technological potentials of the new medium were made to serve in the commercial interests of the marketplace. The social values of communications were engulfed by private economic interests. Television's unique ability to reach a national audience and to do so instantaneously and uniformly made it immediately attractive to consumer industries seeking a mass audience. This encouraged the development of a highly centralized networking system as opposed to the local system of autonomous stations envisioned in the Communications Act. The broadcasting license has become an extremely valuable piece of paper, worth as much as $150 million in the case of the New York flagship stations. A station built in one of the largest 50 markets 20 years ago, for an initial capital investment of about $1 million, can now be sold for approximately $20 million.
There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail.
This Undercurrent special here on WBAI in New York. As you know, we have been doing emergency programming regarding the situation, the hot war in El Salvador, a war that has been rather deadly over some time now, and it has escalated clearly over the last several weeks. On today's program, we're going to have a very close look at the history of the war, and particularly the history of death squad activity in the war, where the death squads come from, and also a very close look at the political military structure in El Salvador and how that structure is supported extensively by U.S. forces. My name is Dennis Bernstein, and I am here for this two-hour special. My special guest in the studio at this point is Alan Marin, who is an investigative reporter who has reported extensively on death squad activities in El Salvador, in Guatemala. He has written on these of the New Republic, the New York Times, the Progressive magazine, and many other places. Alan Marin has been to El Salvador on a number of occasions, and he knows the comings and goings of that country quite well. Later on in the broadcast, I believe we'll be speaking with Linda Fuentes, who is with the UMN, that's the Union of Salvadoran Women, about the impact of this war and of U.S. aid from the other side. So first we'll look at from the U.S. going down and then what it means from the Salvadoran side. So we welcome you to join us in this two-hour investigation of El Salvador. And joining me in the studio now is Alan Marin, along with Jane Luters. And our engineer is Shelton Walton. Katie Busing is assisting in this production. Before we go to Alan Marin and take a deep look at how these death squads were formed and how they act, we want to let you hear the actual voice of a death squad defector who was in Washington, D.C. recently, and Jane Luters was there to record the press conference and take a look at exactly what this man had to say and a listen to how the reporters responded to him. Jane, why don't you describe a little bit the atmospheric pressure around that press conference? What did it look like? How was the presentation, and what was the response of the reporters?
Okay. Joya Martinez had defected from a Salvadoran Army death squad this past fall, and he was able to escape to the U.S., and he was actually in D.C., I think, for a couple of weeks before he held the press conference, or before it was held. He appeared there with his attorney, an American attorney. The press conference was held in the National Press Club. There was quite a bit of coverage at the press conference, including television cameras and a number of print journalists. Martinez, it was interesting. Martinez, when I first saw him, I was actually a little surprised. I don't know what I had been expecting, but Martinez had this very, he looked sort of boyish somehow. He was wearing army fatigues. And the first thing I think I noticed, and I heard from others after the press conference and talking about his appearance there, what I think we all noticed was this almost excruciating look of pain in his eyes, which sort of betrayed this kind of boyish energy that he had otherwise. He held the press conference. It probably lasted for about an hour, and he was grilled pretty extensively as to the veracity of his statements. I think a lot of people there really wanted, they were really pressing to find out if there had been any U.S. involvement. And what came out in that from his statements, which were translated, of course, into English as he spoke, what came out was that there had been two U.S. advisors in the office working closely with them. I should mention that he came equipped with a drawing of the floor plan of the office that he had worked in, as well as photographs of himself in front of these vans in which he said they had carried out their deeds. And he gave a very intricately detailed explanation of how this was carried out, how he felt that the U.S. advisors were well aware of what was going on, although he made it very clear that, one, he did not know their names, which I think bothered some of the reporters there who were trying to get specific names. He didn't know the U.S. advisors' names. He did know certainly the Salvadorans whom he had served under. So pretty much through this visual explanation, using floor plans and photographs, which I think the listener, when you hear him sort of moving away from the audio, or his audio gets very weak at points, he was pointing out, he was either pointing to photographs or pointing to a visual aid to try to express what was going on then. That's what's happening. To give you a little bit of background on him, he said that he had started in this particular unit he worked in which he had killed a number of people, in 1987. And he had been told that his particular department actually started its operations in 1982. Martinez was drafted into the Army, forcefully drafted, which is the case of many of the Salvadoran men who do serve in the Army or actually in the guerrilla forces as well, drafted in 1981. And he compared the training he received to that the U.S. SEALs receive. And a couple of other things, he said that the Treasury Department has 16 of these vans, which he describes as being death squad vehicles.
All right. Well, let's give a listen to Hoyer Martinez, who appeared at the National Press Club November 1st in front of a number of journalists.
Es interesante lo que hizo el señor Cristiani en el departamento.
It's interesting what Mr. Cristiani did in our department.
La primera brigada sufrió un ataque de morteros.
The first brigade was attacked with mortars.
Lo primero que hizo el presidente Cristiani fue visitar el departamento 2.
The first thing that Cristiani did was he visited the department 2.
Entrevistarse con el mayor Díaz Hernández.
He had a meeting with Major Díaz Hernández.
Entrevistarse con el coronel Orlando Cepeda.
And with Colonel Orlando Cepeda.
Antes de que el mayor Díaz Hernández fuera a briefing, a reunirse con el presidente.
Before Díaz Hernández went to the briefing and to meet with the president.
Los comandos de fuerzas especiales le especificamos que necesitábamos otro vehículo.
Our special forces commando declared to him that we needed another vehicle.
Se reunieron con muchas personas, jefes que yo no conozco.
And they got together, the president got together with a lot of people that I do not know.
A terminar la reunión con el presidente.
After the meeting with the president was over,
el mayor Díaz Hernández reunió a los comandos de fuerzas especiales.
Major Díaz Hernández got together with the commando of special forces.
Dijo,
and he said to us,
hoy tenemos el apoyo.
Today we have the support.
Podemos incrementar las operaciones futurales.
We can increase the level of future operations.
Dentro de tres días viene un vehículo que ustedes necesitaban.
In 3 days, the vehicle that you need will arrive.
Y así fue. Ese vehículo fue proporcionado por los asesores norteamericanos.
That vehicle you see there was given to us by the American advisors.
Este vehículo servía y desempeñaba un papel muy importante en el departamento.
This vehicle was part of had a very important role in the department.
Ustedes pueden ver que es un vehículo con vidrio polarizado.
You can see that it is a vehicle with polarized windows.
Este vehículo se introducía en personas.
In this vehicle we would introduce to people.
Realizábamos operaciones clandestinas.
We would realize these clandestine operations.
Degollábamos personas ahí.
We would slit people's throats inside the car.
Sacábamos de la cárcel clandestina para irlos a botar a los cementerios.
We would take them and deposit them in these clandestine cemeteries.
No creo que los americanos lo hayan dado para ir a pasear a la colonia Escalón.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Our guest for the hour, Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine. It's coming out today, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. I want to move from the individual body being shocked to the body politic. You talked about Chile. Let's talk about Iraq, the privatization of war in Iraq. We have this breaking news out of Iraq today. The Iraqi government says it's pulling the license of the U.S. security company Blackwater over its involvement in a fatal shooting in Baghdad on Sunday. Interior Ministry spokesperson Abdul Karim Khalaf said 8 civilians were killed and 13 wounded when security contractors believed to be working for Blackwater USA opened fire in a predominantly Sunni neighborhood of western Baghdad. Khalaf said, quote, "We have canceled the license of Blackwater and prevented them from working all over Iraqi territory. We will also refer those involved to Iraqi judicial authorities." It was not immediately clear if the measure against Blackwater is intended to be temporary or permanent. Naomi Klein, take it from there.
Well, that's an extraordinary piece of news. I mean, this is really the first time that one of these mercenary firms may actually be held accountable. You know, as Jeremy Scahill's written in his incredible book, Blackwater, The Rise of the Most Powerful Mercenary Army, the real problem is you know, there haven't been prosecutions. These companies work in this absolute gray zone, you know, they're either Boy Scouts and nothing's gone wrong, which completely doesn't mesh with what we know about the way they're behaving in Iraq and all of the sort of videos that we've seen online of just target practice on Iraqi civilians, or the lawlessness and the immunity in which they work has protected them. So, you know, if the Iraqi government is actually going to kick Blackwater out of Iraq, it could really be a turning point in terms of the pulling these companies into the law and questioning the whole premise of why this level of privatization and lawlessness has been allowed to take place. But, you know, I mentioned how Donald Rumsfeld was a student of Milton Friedman's in the 60s, actually. And the thing about Donald Rumsfeld is he really went beyond his mentor, because Milton Friedman, as I said earlier, he believed that the only acceptable role for government was policing, what was the military. That was the only thing he really thought the government should do. Everything else should be privatized. Donald Rumsfeld studied with Friedman, saw him as a mentor, celebrated his birthday every year with him. But he really took this one step further, because Rumsfeld believed that actually the work of policing and of war fighting could also be privatized and outsourced. And he made this very clear. This was really his mission of transformation, which I think is really not understood how radical it was. You know, we hear this phrase, and we hear Bush praising Rumsfeld for his radical vision of transformation of the military. And it's all these sort of buzzwords that are hard to understand. But if we look at what Rumsfeld's record was.
Demasiado rápido confiaba.
Lista with Burn, Baby Burn, and Lista will be back same time next Thursday for one of the best music shows you'll ever hear. It is 6 o'clock in the morning on WBAI New York, WBAI.org on the web. This is Wake Up Call.
Hold on.
Welcome to Wake Up Call. It's Thursday, May 18, 2006. I'm Deepa Fernandez. In the 7 o'clock hour today, we go to Capitol Hill, where General Michael Hayden, the man who very likely dreamed up the scheme to have the government secretly pay telephone companies to hand over the logs of who we are all calling is before the Senate in his confirmation hearings to be the chief spy. Seem a little twisted? Well, we then delve into many things twisted, from the stolen 2004 election to the already stole 2008 election, with the real deal on U.S. oil interests in Iraq and Venezuela, for that matter, as well as many other chilling and twisted stories that are all true, yet not reported anywhere in this country. We'll be joined by one of the premier investigative journalists in the country who can't get a job for a U.S. media outlet. Greg Pallast joins me in the 7 o'clock hour as we delve into many of the exposés in his latest book, Armed Madhouse, Who's Afraid of Osama Wolf, China Floats, Bush Sinks, and the Scheme to Steal 08, No Child Behind Left, and other dispatches from the front lines of class war. But first this hour, a special treat where flamenco guitar means meets literary Spain, or live in our studios. We also hear about a...
Every paper brings the news that... I find it very interesting that on Dr. King's birthday, a lot of the focus is on his death. One of the reasons why, I would think, is because there's still a lot of controversy over the death of Dr. King. And he was killed in the middle of doing his work. His work was not over. He was still vibrant, very active in the work that he was doing. In fact, he was working that evening when he was in Memphis, and he was assassinated by, well, we're going to find out who did do that, or at least we'll have the benefit of some research that was done, by William F. Pepper. William F. Pepper is an English barrister and an American lawyer. He practices international human rights law from London and convenes a seminar on international human rights at Oxford University, has represented governments and heads of state, and appeared as an expert on international law issues. He is the author of three other books and numerous articles. And I've been joined in the studio this morning by Dr. Majid Ali, who's usually here around this time on Monday.
Hi.
All right, and as well as Bob Lederer, who comes in a little later on at this time on Monday.
Good to be here, Bernard.
Okay. I'll be talking to William F.
Radio came to the New York area Sunday when the new WBAI 99.5 megacycles went on the air at 8 a.m. with the playing of a Bach cantata. When the new station signed off at midnight, it had presented the first day ever heard in New York in environs of broadcasting uncluttered with commercials, trivia, noise, trash, city preemptions, moronism, shouting announcers, plugs, distorted news, and the like. In its first 16 hours, the new WBAI featured a concert of choral music, a documentary on the BBC's history, a program of American music, a panel discussion on payola and mental poverty, a complete performance of the St. John Passion, two programs of news commentary, a discussion of films, an Australian folk opera, a discussion of jazz, and a solid hour of uninterrupted jazz recordings, a concert of Scarlatti sonatas, and several miscellaneous programs. This is not a loaded first day's programming. I've seen the station's program folios for several months in advance, and last Sunday's and today's programming will be surpassed in interest and variety soon. From the Village Voice, January 13th, 1960.
And that was, we finished up with a reading there of a article that appeared in the Village Voice after WBAI came on the air as part of Pacifica. I'm joined in studio right now by Sean Rhodes. And I played for you a series of pieces from our history. We'll be getting back to that in a moment. We heard from Deepa Fernandez and Wake Up Call. We heard from Amy Goodman interviewing Naomi Klein. We also heard, going back to Contra, a ContraGate program, a special with Dennis Bernstein on death squads in El Salvador. And I opened up this period, this part of the broadcast, with a broadcast from WBAI that harks back to 1971, and it's called Image Empire, and that's the piece where we heard the revolution will not be televised. And we heard a bit from Bernard White and his interview with Claude Pepper, though I disconnected that interview accidentally, and we'll get back to it. And I want to, and just before that, after that, we heard the the piece from The Village Voice. And I'm joined in studio by Sean Rhodes.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Sean, because we have been getting letters. You can also send a letter to us, and if we can, we'll read your letter on the air at, I believe it's birthday at WBAI.org. And we have some stuff from listeners. So you want to read a letter, Sean?
Sure. This is titled Happy Birthday WBAI from Gary. And this says, hi, folks. I'd like to say that WBAI taught me my very first religious lesson. It's called guilt. I began listening to Steve Post's program in November 1971. My mom and I made our first contribution to WBAI in 1972, May of 1972. The month after that, Steve went off the air. Can we get our money back, please? Seriously speaking, WBAI enriches my life so much with its news and music programs. Since I have cerebral palsy, I appreciate the largest minority. I live in a nursing home with my mom here in Long Beach. Since I can't speak, I communicate by my computer. I'm afraid Governor Patterson will take our funding away. That's why I'm a member of WBAI till this day. I remain devoted to BAI because I think it's urgent for me to do so. Sincerely, Gary.
And I have a one from Lewis Schweitzer, subject Lewis Schweitzer, Joni Grant, is from Chris. Happy anniversary, WBAI, and may there be many more. That said, I was glad to hear Lewis Schweitzer remembered at the beginning of your anniversary program, but I wish Janet Coleman had done her homework before so totally twisting the facts. Lou was a remarkable man without whom there would be no BAI Pacifica station. He was at one point maligned by people at the station who accused him of interfering in program content. Lou never did that. He had his criticism of our programs as well as much praise, but he never tried to influence us. Even when false accusations were leveled at him by staff, Lou continued to pay our rent and sometimes salaries. Okay, please don't forget to honor Joni Grant in your reminiscence. She was our news director and also the first black person to hold that position. She and I were having lunch one day. The station was $25,000 in debt, and we hatched the first marathon. It raised more than the pledged amount, by the way. Okay, that's from Chris.
Okay, my turn. This is entitled Steve Post and Bob Fass Saved My Life from Newsboy. And this reads, one of the darkest and most educational periods of my youth was around 1970 when I and my brothers dutifully worked in a dirty, grimy garage near LaFranc City in the wee hours every Saturday night, Sunday morning, collating the Sunday papers. In that darkness, a radio tuned to 99.5 was the only thing that kept me sane when loneliness and despair could have overwhelmed. I believe it was Steve Post in particular, but Bob Fass, Larry Josephson were prominent. Not to mention the Laughing Cavalier reading The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, and so many others, too many to mention in this short note. P.S. After years of disappointment, recently perhaps I will find that connection again? Thanks, Andy.
And this is from Mike Fader. It's an incredible thrill to hear all the people in the studio now. WBAI was a combination lifesaver and comprehensive education on everything imaginable to me and those of thousands of other people. After growing up in the 50s and early 60s, listening to WBAI was like stepping out of straitjacket and launching out into great, endless, beautiful space.
Let's see. This is titled Happy Birthday, WBAI, from Shafar Azad. This reads, I am familiar with WBAI for the past 40 years out of 50 and enjoy today's reminders. I am hoping to hear something today from, by, or about Lynn Samuel. She had given special, what is it? Corrector? To WBAI at the time, when the pledge number was 212-279-3400. I remember that when I first came. Thank you, and keep up the good work. P.S. I came to New York State from Tehran, Iran, 1968, starting to and learned from WBAI Radio 1970 while I was learning English. Shafa Azad. Thank you.
And this is from Nan Rubin playing in the FM band. It's the subject. Love hearing the real old fogies on the air talking about the early days of the station. Haven't heard from some of those folks. My own story about doing a co-op job in New York City when I was 17 and hearing Larry J in the morning and Steve Post late that night, which did more than blow my mind, but literally changed my life. Look at me now, having dedicated my career to building disreputable community radio stations and making trouble in the FM band. Which brings me to my offer. I don't know how, but I have to count them to copies of Steve's book playing for the FM band. And she wants to send a copy to the first person who makes a $100 donation to the station as a birthday present. Well, that's lovely. So if you want to make a $100 donation to WBAI, call on Monday and speak to the receptionist at 212-209-2800. Or you can go to our website at WBAI.org and make a donation. If someone there makes a donation for $100 on the website, I'm sure we can get them a book.
Cool. Let's see. I have a final one here. This is entitled, Don't Forget to Thank Rudy Keisley from Patty Heffley. This reads, I think Rudy pushed for this to happen. Please thank him for his long interest in the station. I wish I had known. I have lots of archival audio from my early days of listening from 1988 through the first Gulf invasion, which isn't that early, but an interesting time. Patty Heffley. Well, thank you, Rudy. Patty.
And this is subject Ursay et al., and this is from Eve Sinaiko. Happy birthday, WBAI. Shout out to Steve Post, a thank you for the work of Margot Adler and Amy Goodman and so many others, and a special hello to James Ursay, whose programs were the soundtrack to my late night time in the studio for many years. I have a particularly fond memory of the night he discovered a creaky recording of Alessandro Moreschi, The Last Castrato. Okay, kept playing it out. I think people talked about that this morning. Mm-hmm. Okay, and I have another happy birthday Let's Go Another 50 from Shiloh. Okay, thank you, Shiloh. And from Linda Clark, it's subject Chris 50 more. Happy birthday, WBAI. Many more, WBAI staff, volunteers, personalities. Thank you for helping me graduate college by keeping me awake through all those all-night assignments. Thank you for teaching me things even my university wouldn't. Yes, I'd love to share some cake with all you, too. Big up to Omawali Clay and Roger Wareham and put me on the station, Ron McGuire. And CUNY Emission Deferred, who put me on the air. Okay, so that's Linda. Thank you, Linda.
All right, so again, as Kathy announced, you can send your congratulatory wishes and emails to birthday@wbai.org, and we'll read it here on the air while we still got time. And this is going on in this, from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., and at which point Max Schmid will come on with a special edition of Golden Age of Radio.
And I'm going to go back to some clips from our 50 years are past and present. As it seems, I'm going to go to the Peter Beauchene mix, starting with Julius Lester, and then I'll be going to...
Oh, but before you do that, let me just thank once again the owner of, what is it, Subway Sandwich Shop here mm-hmm. at 122 Water Street, and his name is Fethi Hassau. Thank you for the delicious meal that you provided to us. Folks are partaking, and we're enjoying it. And we encourage our listenership to visit the store of someone who is supporting WBAI. So again, thank you, Subway Sandwich Shop at 122 Water Street.
And for those of you who would like to support WBAI today, you go to WBAI.org where you can do that.
I hate to sit here and sound as if I'm beating BAI's drum, but I really feel sometimes that the station is taken too much for granted. That such regular things as live music, live drama, I think people have come to accept and expect and not think anything of and not think anything extraordinary of them. And I think if there's one thing which I guess a lot of people have lost and which I haven't lost even though I've been at this ridiculous place for 6 years now, is the sense of wonderment and awe that a place like BAI exists.
This is WBAI in New York City. Sorry as you may be to hear that. And my name has been James Irsay. It's exactly noon, and that means that it's time for our program!
The 1st Battalion of the 5th Marines have something in common. They are both being destroyed, piece by piece, house by house, man by man. Much of the city lies in rubble now, and ground and naval artillery, tanks, mortars, and rockets continue to blast at what remains as the battle for the Imperial Walled City goes into its 21st day, one of the bitterest battles of the Vietnam War. To the reporters there, the reality we found was in shocking contrast to the official pronouncements on the situation offered in Saigon and Washington. Officially, it seems the Battle of Hue is now only a mopping-up exercise. 4 days ago in Saigon, I was invited to attend a victory celebration of an Arvin paratroop battalion that had just returned from Hue. All over but the mopping up. Lyndon Johnson on the 6th of February compared the situation to insecurity in Detroit and Washington, where any small group of people can make trouble for a little while. The reality is very different. As one Marine sergeant put it, if this is mopping up, I'd hate to see a real battle. The Marines, who for the past several days have been doing nearly all of the fighting themselves, have taken heavy, repeat heavy casualties. They are almost 50% under strength as of yesterday, and they are not being reinforced. Their own commandant has said they didn't need reinforcement and repeated the story that it was all a mopping-up operation. Some observers speculate that this is due purely to political requirements, the current official line being that it's total victory everywhere. The Marines are understandably bitter. They are taking casualties because weather has made airstrikes impossible for several days, but also because airstrikes are at this point forbidden in some areas in an effort to prevent the destruction of historical shrines and artworks. They are not being reinforced because officials contend in something out of 1984 that the bloody battle they are fighting doesn't exist. Mopping up it is.
It is now 10 o'clock at night, an eerie night with flares over the city and naval gunfire falling on North Vietnamese positions along the wall, in some cases only two or three blocks away. The line, as a matter of fact, is said to be about a block away. Imperial City of Hue is being torn apart. Much of it already has been destroyed.
If the United States government is failing or refusing or choosing not to recognize what the government of Panama presents as its official and legal representatives, would it be out of line to suggest that this is part of an effort to overthrow the government of Panama?
Definitely. Definitely, because it's all part of the plan and part of the scheme. Because first they come with the economic embargo, then they take over the embassy and the consulate, and they have all the legal machinery behind them. Then they're going to perhaps go into a trade embargo, and then from there, who knows? Perhaps military intervention, just like Mr. Paredes said this evening on Morton Downey's show. He said that he did not agree with military intervention, but then he contradicted himself in the course of the program, because then when the people that was the commentator and the audience was telling him, well, this canal, the canal, Panama and the canal belongs to us. So therefore, we have a right to take it over. We have a right to annul the treaties in the past because we have this canal in perpetuity. Then he started now to do the same thing that we're doing in terms of that the real issue here is the canal issue, that in the year 2000, that canal will not be reverted to Panamanians, that canal will remain the territory of the United States.
We will, in just a few minutes, take a much closer look at the issue of the canal. I'm just wondering about one other thing in regard to the diplomatic relations between the two nations. Why, then, have not diplomatic relations been severed between the governments of Panama and the United States?
Well, I believe that the events are happening so rapidly. They're happening so rapidly. We have problems to deal with at home. You know, first, I think this question of the economic embargo, which would perhaps go on for another 10 days or so, you know, is very serious, because you're talking about a total collapse of the economy and people not being able to get their children back into school, which is coming up very soon, people not being able to cash their checks, who knows? And then, of course, there's, you know, this group of people that are organizing to overthrow the government, you know, they are also committing acts of vandalism and disorder. So, you know, there's lots of problems at home.
The disorders that are possible to take place in Panama could raise some very troublesome questions in regard to the canal. Let's just set the context in regard to the Panama Canal Treaty and Neutrality Treaty, which were negotiated in 1977, ratified by the United States Congress in 1978, with a reservation by Senator DeConcini, which provided for the intervention, including military force, in Panama in the event that the operations of the canal were to be disrupted. Do you see that as a plausible event, given recent developments?
No. The functioning of the canal should not be interrupted under any circumstance. I don't see why it should be. In terms of the situation, no, because you remember there's a Panama Canal Commission and there's a joint keeping of the forces in order to maintain the freedom of the waterways. I don't foresee any closing of the canal.
Well, at the same time,
at least on the Panamanian people's side, you know, I don't see that as an event now. Right now, everything is working okay. I guess there is I read in the newspaper there was somewhat of a backlog of the ships the other day. But then, you know, they have been also, I think, a withholding of the payments for the canal.
Well, yes, indeed. As a matter of fact, a part of the economic pressures is the threatened withholding of approximately $7 million in canal revenues due the government of Panama from the United States. I believe that payment becomes due next Tuesday on the 15th of March. Now, however, that particular issue is resolved. The Panama Canal Commission itself, which is comprised of five American members, or the board of it is comprised of five American members and four Panamanians, and an American official sits as the administrator of the canal. The commission has said that it was not inclined to get involved in the question of this particular payment, saying that it was a dispute between the two nations.
Mm-hmm.
However, the terms of the treaty provide that in 1989, or at the end of 1989, that a Panamanian national shall be proposed for confirmation by the United States President as the administrator of the canal. In addition, according to the Panamanian Constitution, elections are scheduled for 1989, thus whatever government shall be in place at that time would be in a very pivotal position in terms of the canal's disposition. Do you think that these are factors in the recent and rapid emergence of pressure?
Absolutely, because the government prior to 1968 was composed of the oligarchy, and these are the same people now that have been trying to overthrow the government because they want to be in power in 1989 in order to get in back into the business of the canal. It's very obvious, you know, all what has been done. We keep saying that, but nobody's listening to us, that the real issue here is the canal. Ultimately, the real issue here is the canal. The other things are just factors that are being used right now to try and make Panama another example of what, I don't know. But the real issue here that people have to know is who is going to be in power in the year 1989 and onwards.
I'd say that that question has occurred to some leaders in the United States. For instance, Senator Robert Dole stated over the weekend that Americans should just say no to drugs, say no to Noriega, and no, maybe, to giving them the canal. He added that the United States may want to go back and take another look at those treaties, which he happened to oppose rather vigorously in 1977. Now, the charge will be made that the current actions against the Panamanian government are based on the non-viability of the leadership of General Noriega in the face of widespread corruption and drug charges that have been made against him, and that this is the reason for the pressure towards what is termed democratization in Panama. How do you respond to that?
I believe that General Noriega has been used as a scapegoat because he is not the issue here. He is not the president of the Republic of Panama. He is a member of the Forces of Defense, which is just a party, you know, an institution within the government. And the president of the Republic of Panama is the person that carries the foreign policy. I believe, my personal opinion is, that the charges and the allegations that have been made against General Noriega are just an excuse and a political maneuver for the United States to get to the issue of who will control the canal in the year 2000.
Five people were killed in a shootout with police and the FBI in Los Angeles last night. The five were identified by the police as suspected members of the Symbionese Liberation Army. There was a tentative identification of two of those killed. They were reportedly Donald DeFries, Field Marshal Sinque of the SLA, and Camila Hall, a white woman also alleged to be a member of the group. Another white woman, said to resemble kidnapped newspaper heiress Patricia Hearst, was said to have been in the building as late as yesterday morning, but it was not known whether she was there when the gun battle broke out or whether she was among the dead.
To those who would bear the hopes and future of our people, let the voice of their guns express the words of freedom. I would like to begin this statement by informing the public that I wrote what I'm about to say. It's what I feel. I've never been forced to say anything on any tape, nor have I been brainwashed, drugged, tortured, hypnotized, or in any way confused. As George Jackson wrote, it's me, the way I want it, the way I see it.
Finally tonight, word that Patricia Hearst, free on $1.2 million bond after being convicted of bank robbery as a member of the SLA, spent last weekend in Las Vegas as a guest of singer Frank Sinatra. The newspaper heiress arrived on Saturday via commercial airliner and, according to police in Las Vegas, registered with the police department. Local ordinances require convicted felons to register if their stay is more than 48 hours. Hearst departed yesterday after some 50 hours in town. She was accompanied by an off-duty San Francisco police officer reportedly hired by her publisher father as a bodyguard. I'm Marty Goldenson.
And the Ayatollah Khomeini, the Muslim leader who spearheaded the revolution against the Shah, today proclaimed in Iran an Islamic Republic, even before all the votes in his weekend referendum were counted. The Provisional Revolutionary Government, meanwhile, issued an ultimatum to Turkoman guerrillas fighting for greater self-rule in the northeast near the Soviet border. The Ayatollah, in a statement read on Iran radio today, said the people had unanimously approved an Islamic Republic in the two-day national referendum, which ended yesterday. He said the people of Iran had buried 2,500 years of monarchy, quote, in the garbage dump of history. And now I'm going to turn the microphone over to Celeste Wesson, who again today has been gathering information from around the country, and she'll fill us in a little bit more.
Okay, President Carter's... Okay, President Carter stopped in today at the Three Mile Island Nuclear Power Plant for a brief visit to the site of the worst nuclear power accident in U.S. history, an accident that's not improving, a situation that's not improving, a bad accident that seems to be getting worse. The hydrogen bubble, right, that's been blocking the cooling flow from the reactor, from reaching the reactor to cool it down, is still there. That cooling flow, which would, of course, ultimately help avoid any kind of meltdown. The hydrogen bubble is causing other problems, too. It's apparently a situation in which the hydrogen could explode. They're trying to work on that hydrogen so that it doesn't explode.
And finally, we continue with our reading of the CIA Manual for Guerrilla Warfare in Nicaragua, produced by Robert Knight.
Today's reading of Psychological Operations in Guerrilla Warfare is by Jesuit priest Father Daniel Berrigan, who has recently returned from Nicaragua's northern Ocotal province, where he claims the manual's tactics are being implemented by Contra forces.
And we just heard a few segments from a CD produced by Peter Beauchamp, the best of WBAI, and that last piece was representing the WBAI news. Before that, we heard Dale Miner's report from Vietnam, and a little bit before that, we heard a segment of a Panama special produced, I believe it was in 1998, I think it was, by Robert Knight for WBAI News. And coming up, as we are moving into a representation of music and live music here at WBAI, hosted by Delphine Blue, but I thought it might be interesting for her and for all of you to hear just a little bit of a fellow who used to be here on WBAI called Gary Noll.
One of the main benefits from the Gerson therapy, and an overwhelming number of the cancer cases I personally interviewed, is the relief of pain. In 1946, Dr. George Miley of the Gotham Hospital in New York testified before a congressional hearing on cancer research that was using the Gerson diet. He said, "We have observed marked relief of pain in approximately 90% of the patients who entered the hospital with severe pain due to cancer, unquote. He pointed out that the only other way to abolish pain was through the use of narcotics, which, of course, as we know, has deleterious effects on the patient's general health.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive. Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.